You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
The targets we've set are bold, and by empowering businesses, scientists, engineers, workers, and the private sector, investors, to work together, this agreement represents the best chance we've had to save the one planet that we've got.
An historical climate deal has been reached, but will it be enough? My guests, Robert Fox and Daniela Pellet, will tell us their thoughts on this and the day's other top stories, including Saudi Arabia elects women to municipal positions for the first time, and in France, the far-right Front National falls short in the regional elections. Also ahead, we look to Iran, where for the first time a taboo has been broken over the selection of the country's supreme leader. And finally, you've got mail. US and Cuba restore postal services between the two nations. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, right here on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House. And so, as I said at the top, my guests today are Robert Fox and Daniela Pellet. Robert Fox is the defence editor for the London Evening Standard, and Daniela Pellet is the editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both to the show as usual. Now, we're going to start today's programme in Paris, where over the weekend, 195 countries signed an historic climate deal. This is the first universal and legally binding climate deal that aims to hold global temperatures to a maximum rise of 1.5 centigrade above pre-industrial levels. French President François Hollande has described it as a major leap for mankind. Is it, Robert?
Yeah, what I have left of an eyebrow shot up there when you said legally binding, because I don't think it is. I think that this is the problem. A lot of it is by agreement. A lot of it, there is a promise to put into law, national law, but there's a lot that is left aside by a consensus. The turnaround, which I suppose we'll have to break out, is that there has been agreement. You're absolutely right there. And this is really against the background of the chaos of the last big climate conference, which was in Copenhagen, which really ended up in a shambles with the newly empowered, elected, and he was only a few weeks in office, Barack Obama, breaking into the meeting and saying, now get your act together, which they only half did. In fact, Barack Obama's comments on this are extremely interesting. He said it's been a very, very steep learning curve for him in international politics. He's delighted that this has happened, but he is well aware that he's got an extremely hostile Congress and that every single one of the front-running 10 on the Republican slate for the presidency to succeed him has said that they're going to roll this back. So, you know, it's one step forward and two to the side, and, you know, it's a four-dimensional chess game.
You want to jump in? The one thing I think is kind of extraordinary. At a time when we every kind of week seem to talk about Syria, and you can't get Russia and America to agree on anything. You can't get any two countries to agree on anything with a big political issue like that. Somehow, and maybe it is because, you know, these countries all realise that they're going to get hurt if they don't get their acts together. But it is kind of amazing to get all these countries to, as an act of diplomacy, of the manoeuvring that the French did. You know, really commendable, even just on that stage, don't you think?
I think whether it saves the world is highly debatable, but certainly there's no doubt in my mind that diplomatically it was an immense success. 195 countries with very different agendas in the same place at the same time, they reached an agreement. I think partly this is because very little of it is legally binding. And I think it is down to a number of reasons, partly a confluence of interest in some areas. China is already changing and redeveloping its industry.
Well, don't you think the Chinese are scared that they might have kind of like a bit of, you know, domestic revolution on their hands if they don't begin to kind of clean up some of their cities? You know, they realise people are living in constant smog, and they're beginning to connect the fact that their kids are sick and they're sick because, you know, their government isn't doing something about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. It's chimes with their own strategy. They're pursuing that route already. I would like to think perhaps that the French had something to do with this as well. I can kind of see the French hosting a conference this scale. I feel replete with food and wine. And
well, there was this interesting story.
Very well.
I think everybody was really admiring of what he did. And I think that apparently they used this kind of, you know, a South African adopted a system of like these big meetings and small meetings. They knew how to kind of marshal people along. So that, you know, that they got people signed up to like the bigger notions earlier on.
And I think the fact that it was held in France, you know, a month after the attacks, also had something on the sense of unity. So I think, yeah, diplomatically and as a model for another way of getting stuff done, or reaching, rather than getting stuff done, reaching an agreement, because I'm not bowled over by the chances of any of these very, very ambitious plans actually coming to fruition.
Robert?
I think they have shifted the agenda, though, and I think that this is the really interesting thing, that the climate change deniers have absolutely all but disappeared now because science has taken over. Yes, that they put an extremely ambitious goal on it, as Daniela was saying, you know, 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial level. Well, we're now one above, and I don't quite know how the maths are doing. The very distinguished science editor of the New York Times says that actually, even with what they've put in, it would be about 3.7. I'm just not qualified to talk about that scientific level, but several other things happened in that they really were pushing forward, so that one feels there may be something of a tipping point here, because as Daniela rightly pointed out, that China has really turned around and is really scared about the effects of heavy industrial pollution driven by coal-fired industry and so on. And the great naysayer was supposed to be India, because it's so dependent on fossil fuel for its industrial takeoff, which is roaring away. Well, they came to an agreement about that. They said, look, we will rein back, but guys, can you help us? Ask the developed world. And this was really good, the drawing together of the developed world and filling up the pot to invest in this research. And on the side, these small meetings that you referred to, very, very important things were discussed. At last, they talked, one, very specifically about the connection between climate change and mass migration, whether it's causal, catalytic, or just conditional, or incidental. But it is very important. And the figures that weren't widely reported that started coming up of people moving from very deprived, developing or underdeveloped regions is about 160 million people on the move currently. Now, the fact that they were getting round and they were talking to each other about it, north-south in the old dialogue and the east-west, I think there really is something. Funny enough, what I would say, reading the footnotes in this, I think the media are taking a bit of time to catch up with some of the things that were really discussed. But they didn't come out of it saying, yaboo, you're wrong, so we're not going to do it. It's only the political right that is saying that. I referred to the Republicans, but there's a sort of perfectly daft editorial line in the Conservative Daily Telegraph in UK today saying, oh, why should we do it? Because we're the only ones who are prepared to make it legally binding. Absolute nonsense.
Just before I bring down, on your day job is being a defence editor, and we're talking here about climate change.
Completely related.
I was going to say, how connected do you think the two are?
I think they're very connected. In fact, I don't see myself. I mean, although I do the guns and bangs a bit. That's just the pointy end of it, and a very small point of it. Actually, I spent most of my working life as an international journalist doing political, social, economic movements, things like women's rights. These are major strategic issues, and talking to my interlocutors in big organisations like NATO, they're taking a heck of a long time to catch up with it. Senior generals have been saying to me, oh, what has population movement and climate change got to do with the strategic things that I have to think about? I come up with quite a long word, but it's a one-word answer, everything.
Because, Daniela, you know the Middle East very well, and if you look at a region like, you know, Palestine and Israel, you know, even there, a lot of the disputes, if you took water out of the equation, there'd be a little less to argue about. So even there, climate change kind of influences some of the kind of tussling that's going on, don't you think?
I think climate change makes a big difference in some areas, you know, with Sudan, Darfur, for instance, that seem to be quite decisive. I've heard people trying to attribute the Syrian civil war similarly to climate change.
Prince Charles had a go.
Yeah,
as well.
And you know what? I think that's where we go too far. And being super reductive, all war, in my opinion, is competition over resources. You know, the Israel-Palestine, for instance, is it framed as a religious war or two groups fighting over the same piece of territory? I mean, interestingly, throughout the dull, dark years of Oslo failure, one of the few committees that kept meeting Israel-Palestine was that on water, because they realised that was so, so vital. But still, unequal resources and the unequal distribution of resources does play a part of that. But then I think in that case, a resolution of the conflict would resolve that unequal distribution.
Well, just before we move on, my producer is telling me it's not legally binding in its entirety, but a great part of the agreement is. Well, that's what they say. So we'll see.
But it seems it gets through their parliament.
Yeah, we'll see. That kind of pleases everyone, doesn't it? We're going to move.
So I can't have an argument with your producer.
You can do that afterwards. Stay in the room for now. We're going to move on from one historical event to the next. Let's turn to Saudi Arabia. Women voted and ran in elections for the first time in the country's history. Results indicate that around 17 women have been elected, and even though they represent just 1% of the council seats up for grabs, it is still a step forward. Well, that's what it says here. Is it, Robert?
Well, I think Daniela actually is the one to ask
you just said you used to cover women's rights. I was giving you a chance
to bang the drum. I'm absolutely supportive.
Shall I speak for my gender?
Yeah, please. let's keep this gender-based. You go first.
Don't take any patronising nonsense from two males.
Right. Well, no. Feel free to weigh in at any time. It's historic in the sense that it's the first time something has happened. It's not historic in any meaningful way because it means nothing. And I was thinking about this before we came on air, of how I could possibly think of something positive to say about it, because I don't want to denigrate the efforts of the campaigners that have been working for this on the ground. But I see it as having zero significance. Somewhere an international branding agency is rubbing its hands thinking, oh, what great, we've got a good news story to run about Saudi Arabia. Similarly, did you know that Saudi Arabia has just got a place in the Guinness World Record for getting the largest number of women together.
There's a strange thing in the Guinness Book of World Records. Is something about Saudi Arabia. That shouldn't be. That's not the right place. A drinks brand celebrating Saudi Arabia.
Well,
anyway.
Quite. They're branching out. You know, they've got together the largest group of women to raise awareness about breast cancer. Now, again, that is not just about as meaningful, really. It's complete lip service. This is an opportunity for journalists to run lines about how women going to the polling stations in Saudi Arabia said they'd never see this day. Fine. I mean, that's a great and individual and a very minor victory, but it doesn't go beyond that. Even in other autocratic regimes, you know, men and women have equal rights to vote for the same candidate, you know, without any other option.
And the strange thing, I think, for, you know, Saudi authorities, you'd think that the important thing was that your public was signed up to what you were doing. And the reason you can judge that that's not the case, you know, here in London, only a couple of weeks ago, we had an event here, met a young woman who's here studying medicine, Saudi. She's here in her kind of jeans and T-shirt and her kind of hip jacket, no hint of any kind of headscarf even. You know, and she's just being, you know, a young, cool Londoner when she moves here. When she goes back home, she adopts what's expected of her. Now, she's not trying to, you know, rock the system. But what's interesting is a lot of Saudi women are just not invested in the whole scheme. They know that the minute even they go to Dubai, they kind of, you know, dress in a different way. The rules being placed at home, they don't run that deep in many people who live in the country. And that's, in the end, what you have to worry about these, you know, theocracies is they don't have a chance of really surviving if people don't believe what they're talking about.
Well, I don't know about the long-term survival, and I do think that the prospects are very, very difficult, because I agree with both of you. This is coming from a very, very low base indeed. I mean, the terms in which they were allowed to campaign, they were not allowed to campaign in front of men in certain circumstances, and in the terms in which, when they get to their local authorities, local councils, they're allowed to deliberate and debate. They're not in the same chamber with men and so on and so forth. And I was just picking out from the BBC's report an astonishing remark by King Abdullah. I haven't forgotten that King Abdullah has died, but he was the king that that enabled this opening the franchise very, very a tiny crack to women. He said he was doing it because women have demonstrated positions that expressed correct opinions and advice. It is so far from real democracy, and I think actually you have put your finger on it. Young women, young Saudi women, I deal with them in think tanks and so on, we're absolutely equal, they're brilliant, multilingual, they're so experienced, they're terrific contributors in the West, and they are so stifled and restricted when they go back to Saudi Arabia. And in Saudi particularly, and in some of the other Gulf Cooperation Councils, it's the education gap. Young women are becoming highly educated, but the education has no traction at all, exactly as you were suggesting.
Well, let's move on to another woman who didn't also quite get the votes that she wanted this weekend, because this weekend saw did you like my link there? That was quite good, wasn't it?
Very good.
This weekend saw elections in France where the far-right Front National failed to win a single region in the second round of municipal elections, despite leading in 6 out of the 13 regions in the first round last week. The party was beaten into third place, with the centre-right Republicans finishing ahead of the governing Socialist Party. Now, we know there's lots of kind of manoeuvring went on with tactical voting here, which kind of stopped the far right in its tracks. It seemed to kind of get roughly the vote that it expected to, but it just didn't have the breakthroughs.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should be cautious describing this as a defeat for the Front National. They didn't, obviously, and it's better that they haven't won these districts. But still, I think a huge amount of people turned out to vote for them. I think 6.1 million people, which is like one in every 10 French citizens. My maths is not wonderful. And this has in no way served as a stumbling block for Marine Le Pen when it comes to the big one, the presidential election. She's been portraying this, as well she might, because it's an easy point to make, as another example of the political elite manoeuvring to
She has got a slight point. There was manoeuvring by the established parties to keep her out of power.
Exactly. It was all tactical voting, and she's using this to her advantage to say we speak for the people, and this is how the political elites are trying to keep the people's voice quiet. And don't forget, she's certainly taken the party in a different path from that of her father, you know, much more reasonable and less strident in many ways. Although their position on immigration and Muslims remain staunchly the same and immovable. So they still remain very, very much a force to be reckoned with. And their lack of showing in the regional elections is, as you said, it's something contrived.
Robert, surprising that the attacks in Paris only a few weeks ago, then you know, the country in lockdown when the big hunt was on, actually delivered very little in dividend to the party in these elections. You know, their vote was kind of where everyone thought it was going to sit. Though what's interesting, people weren't panicked by the terror in the way that we might have imagined.
Well, the horse trading that Danielle has described always happens. It happened against her father when he did very well. I can't remember in which of the presidential elections, and they ganged
2002. He had to do well first frighten people.
And this seems to be, deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would say. But I agree with Danielle that I think she is a force. I think she's a very astute politician. She knows what her constituency is. And there was a ganging up, and the real loser was the socialists, because the centre-right took over, had to take over, had to be given the votes of the socialists in two or three of real socialist heartland. So it gives us no indication of what's going to happen in 18 months' time. And there's a lot going on. But it is interesting how the Le Pen flavour in different national cultures really is so strong. It'll be very interesting to see what happens in the Spanish elections in the upcoming weekend. And certainly, I know with the Dutch, the Germans, there is this very strong nationalist, anti-immigrant tendency, although the situation of immigration is so very different in each one of those countries. But thinking where we are in the UK, sorry, it's like Round Britain quiz, that, you know, we've got Mr. Cameron talking about the relationship between the UK and the EU. You have to say, in the light of all this, after the attacks, the migration, the new political and electoral movements in Europe, what EU? What kind of EU is it going to be? Because there is, it is, it certainly doesn't look like an ever closer union now, and it looks as if it's going to have to do some very tough things, the constituent parts, in their own national interest in the year to come.
And just before we move on, Dan, do you think that also one of the things is, you know, that actually Hollande has been pretty good at kind of, you know, stealing some of the thunder in a way? He's been seen as such a kind of outspoken leader, you know, a tough leader over the last few weeks.
Very unexpected.
Yeah. Too. So maybe he kind of dampened some of the enthusiasm for jumping to the right at this point when it seems to be a moment of national crisis.
Yeah, I think so. He rallied much better than he did after the Charlie Hebdo attacks. And he was transformed. What was he before? A blancmange or a meringue? Yeah. I mean, he really did rally around. He provided unexpected leadership. And I think sometimes it's more meaningful when it comes from such an unexpected place. And he also didn't take a sort of immense rabble-rousing sort of populist stance on this. I think he behaved quite respectably and respectfully. So, yeah, I mean, the last thing, I don't know what another atrocity would do to the French body politic. Let's hope we don't find out.
Well, I'm not sure it's so rude being called a meringue. I quite like meringues. We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, and my guests today are Robert Fox and Daniela Pellet. Coming up next, who will be Iran's next supreme leader? And we'll get our stamps ready to send a letter from Havana. Stay tuned.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck. Still with me are my guests for today, Robert Fox and Daniela Pellet. We turn to Iran, where the former president, Akbar Rafsanjani, has said a committee is examining potential candidates to be the next supreme leader, breaking the taboo of talking publicly about succession in the Islamic Republic. It's the first time public discussion on the succession has gained momentum in official circles. Daniela, why do you think they are beginning to talk about this openly in public?
Well, I mean, Iranian politics is hugely internecine and complicated, and there's convoluted alliances between the hardliners and the relative progressives and so on. I don't think it's implausible that Rafsanjani has his eye on the top job anyway. I mean, he's quite a prominent. He's got sort of the religious qualifications. Khamenei had to be like Ayatollah before he could could take up the top job. In terms of its significance towards moving to any kind of greater liberalisation or democracy, I think it's similar to the Saudi Arabia story we talked about. It's indicating another sort of stage in the battle, an infighting battle, rather than moving towards greater transparency, greater openness.
Robert, do you think, you know, Daniel says we can't really think about it in terms of, you know, liberalising. I know that's not quite the right word for Iran, but do you think in a softening of stance, of feeling a little bit more confident about their place in the world, that they can, you know, give back a little bit more power to people, allow some, a little bit more freedom of expression?
It's a generation game. We're moving now 36 years from the Islamic Revolution. We've got to go through the first and second generations hung on for a long time, to the extent that they put in a student revolutionary as a president in Ahmadinejad, who was very much prominent in the student activity in 79 and 80, and that wasn't a great success. I think, though, there is something moving. I agree with Daniela. It is absolutely, opaque isn't the right word, but it is Byzantine in its convolutions, because it seems to me clan-based, interest-based, and there are various blocks, and there's a very important one we must talk about, which is the Revolutionary Guards, because they have a big voice in it, and who is their candidate going to be? It won't be dominant, but they feel that they've been losing ground very much with this outbreak, this terrible rash of diplomacy that's been spreading over the last year to 18 months. And we have to see, absolutely with Daniela here, there is an extraordinary alliance now between Rouhani, who after all is being seen as the success he is. He's got people talking. He's got people talking to Iran. He's got people talking about opening up, much to the chagrin of the hardliners in the Revolutionary Guard, again, as well as the conservative clerics. He seems to have forged an alliance with Rafsanjani, and the other seeming reforming, very astute president also must be brought into the game. What are the Hatemi supporters doing? And it's around this group. And it does look to me as if they really do want to get things moving, because they know that something must be done about the economy. They don't want another Khamenei as a supreme leader, because he's turned out, as expected, to be rather dull, very conservative, with a small C, and with not many ideas. And there's a lot of business to be done. But I do think it's very interesting. But the bits that we never hear about, one comes across with Iranian journalism, are the intelligentsia. There's almost a secular intelligentsia. There are people in public service that we never hear about at all, namely the army command, not the Revolutionary Guard, which is still significant. Still, there's an officer corps which is proud of its traditions, educated and so on, and in bits and pieces of the judiciary, particularly the legal profession as well. So you never know. Again, sorry, I've used the expression before. I'm a friend of Gladwell's, but there may be a kind of tipping point. But can I mention another thing is spiritual leadership. Something over the last two or three months has happened, which is really rather remarkable. The Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani in Najaf has suddenly started saying very interesting things, which the late Ayatollah Khomeini would not like at all. He has told the Shiite leadership in Baghdad to govern for all the Iraqi people and not on behalf of Shia. Don't drag Shia into secular politics in this way. And one of the most interesting candidates coming through and may stand to be supreme leader and may stand to be president is Ayatollah Khomeini's grandson. And he is known to be very critical of the way the Islamic Republic has turned out. So, yeah, am I allowed, non-cynic like me, a cautious bit of hope? I think there are green shoots coming through this. God knows where they're going to sprout or spread to.
Well, that was an amazing briefing. Thank you, Robert. And it is, when you're looking from outside, it always seems, you know, so kind of unified. And then you hear these discussions and you realise there are so many kind of fissures and cracks that run through things. We've got time for a final story. A bit of philately, I think that's the right word.
Which will get you nowhere.
We're going to talk about Cuba and America, because it's been 50 years since a letter or postcard has been sent between the US and Cuba. But the two nations have just announced they will restore a direct postal service. Does anyone care in the age of email?
This is hugely significant and symbolic, and people are watching this very, very closely. I mean, something that hasn't been reported a great deal here is that, but is having an immense effect, is this massive migration crisis in Central America, which, yes, which as Cubans look at this detente that's been growing for the last year, they think, wow, you know, time is running out for us to get to America. As we all know, there's the wet foot policy. If you're caught in sea or sent back dry foot, Cubans can stay in America and probably get residency. And there's an absolute flood of people trying to get out. So while it seems, you know, it's a kind of good news story and the ties are warming for many Cubans, they feel that the gates are closing in on them.
Well, Robert, I don't think I'm going to be able to let you have your view on stamps, because we're coming to the end of the show. You'll have to tell me afterwards whether you're intending to send a
postcard.
First of
all, I'll go to the White House.
Okay. There, you heard it here first. We are going to leave it there, though, for today. Robert Fox and Daniela Pellard, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
and today's show. Well, it was produced by Carlotta Rabello. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilana Hanukov. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Carlotta Rabello will be here to bring you lots of music from the international playlist. And then 1900 hours is the culture show with Mr. Robert Bound. And at 2200 hours, well, it's the Monocle Daily. The show will be back at the same time tomorrow, which is, of course, 1800 hours London time. But from me, Andrew Tuck, just time to say goodbye.